Hello, you're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown. Here, we aim to look at all aspects of brain injury, from the research to the rehabilitation, and always through the lens of speech and language therapy.
Hi, this is Helen.
And this is Jan.
Welcome to this episode of the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. Something a bit different for this episode. You're not going to hear much from us at all. Instead, you'll hear a conversation between Alan and Megan.
You'll have heard Alan talk in episode 9 about his journey of recovery post-brain injury, and he was kind enough to come back and have a chat about speech and language therapy in general. And Megan is a speech and language therapist, and as you'll hear, was in a great position to chat with Alan about why she chose this career and to explain the huge range of factors speech and language therapists can work in. They recorded their conversation in a McDonald's, so there is a bit of background noise at times, although I think overall there were fewer technical issues in this recording than we usually experience.
We'll get to grips with all the technical gremlins someday, I'm sure. Since neither of us had a clue about podcast production until a few months ago, I think we're doing all right, Jan. Anyway, we'll be back at the end with some thoughts on Alan and Megan's discussion, but without further ado, here we go.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.
Hello, my name is Alan Morrison. I was involved in a bad cycling accident last year, and I had several weeks in rehabilitation, where I met a lot of interesting folk. I didn't meet Megan Anderson, who's currently in front of me, who's a speech therapist, and I'm hoping to get some good tips from her and her thoughts this evening. Megan, how long have you been doing speech therapy?
So, I've been working as a speech and language therapist for around 18 months, around a year and a half. Before that, I studied for 4 years at university, and this has been my first role, so I'm fairly new.
Did you not get any placements before you came to rehab?
I did. I had one placement each year, so they were very variable, and they get a bit longer in length. But, you know, they were quite short. The longest placement I had was 10 weeks, and it was only 2 days a week where I was in there. So when I came to my first job, it was a little bit, you know, like seeing it all for the first time.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
When you did any of your placements, was it in anywhere that was a rehabilitation place?
I had one. My very first placement was a brain injury rehabilitation centre. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to mention the name on here, so I'll leave that out for now. But that was only 4 days, so it only really gave me a bit of a taster, but it certainly intrigued my interest, because there 4 years later, here I am.
So that's what attracted you to it in the first place?
That's what attracted me to this job. After that very first placement, I always said, I think I'd like to try working in brain injury.
Right, because I mean, having left rehab, I'm currently seeing an occupational therapist, or not seeing, but I'm Zoom meeting with our occupational therapist in that line. I don't know if it may be the same place, actually. Was it based in the locality? Was it based around about here?
It wasn't based in Glasgow, no. It was like an Lanarkshire service.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But I found it quite helpful, to be honest with you. They've suggested how I should progress it, not from a speech therapy point of view, but just from a purely life point of view. And how did you find the course when you did it? Was it easy or hard?
I had bits of both. You know, I think like everything, the stuff that you find really interesting tends to come a wee bit easier because you enjoy it more. I always found the practical side, you know, going on my placements, I loved that. And I found it fairly fairly easy. Not easy, it was challenging, but it came a bit more naturally to me. And things like writing dissertations and writing essays was a bit more challenging. But it was good, I really enjoyed it.
Was it not quite a hard course to get into in the first place?
Yes, so I had to go and do some work experience before I get into it. And when I'd done the work experience, that's kind of where I discovered that I wanted to do speech and language therapy. So I went to a school for kids with various different disabilities, and I'd done a little bit of shadowing on with speech and language therapy, and with occupational therapy, and with physiotherapy. Because at the time I kind of knew that I wanted to work in healthcare, but I didn't really know where, you know, which path I wanted to go down. And I feel like I still don't really know why I chose speech and language therapy, other than I just liked, enjoyed that the most, and I like to have a blather, so why not?
Well, actually, you've just taken the wind out of my sails, because I was going to ask you why you'd plumped for speech and language therapy, because it's an odd, well, not, it's a peculiar choice. I wouldn't say it was one that was normal, if you say, but I don't mean that sounds bad. I wouldn't say it was one that most people would go for.
Well, and I think that's maybe what kind of struck my interest, because when I went to do my work experience, I hadn't really heard about speech and language therapy, to be honest. I knew what a physio was, I knew what an OT was, but speech and language therapy, I'd heard of it, but I hadn't, you know, I didn't have the slightest idea on what they do, you know. I knew it was going to be something to do with speech, but I thought, I hadn't really met anyone who had difficulties with their speech or their language, so it was... I think that's why it really took my interest because I wanted to know more about it.
It's a peculiar choice. Again, that doesn't sound very well, but it is a peculiar choice, I think, for a lot of people, because I think from, you know, I mean, I had a head injury, and I was probably quite lucky, because when I came round and eventually was compos mentis enough to talk, I didn't really have any particular problems from a speech point of view, so I was probably quite lucky. Mm-hmm. But do you not think there's a lot of people who are badly affected and can't express themselves properly?
Definitely, and I think that's something that's quite challenging with the role, Alan, is because, you know, there's quite often people, it's a hidden disability really, isn't it? Because when you see somebody, you don't know about their speech or their language. And, you know, there's even people when you start to speak to them that you don't hear the difficulties until you maybe start to have a kind of longer conversation, and then you notice things that aren't quite right.
Do you think it, I mean, let's take physiotherapy, and you can see why people who have had injuries or whatever kind, brain injury or whatever, you can see why physiotherapy is probably fundamental to a lot to people like that, because, you know, movement, etc., can be difficult. Do you think that speech is equally as important?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Maybe I'm biased, but yes. I think so, and I think it depends on, you know, everything's individual to the person. So, you know, take someone who uses speech for their job, maybe they work in a call centre, that's probably going to be more important for that person's role.
So you do think it's a fundamental thing that needs to be worked upon?
I do think so. I feel like you look like you disagree with me, Alan.
No, it's an odd one, I think, to choose for. I think, again, I'm probably more prejudiced, that's not fair. It's one that you wouldn't necessarily believe that it was a fundamental for most people. Now, I think when I say that, I can then see the wrong side of what I've just said, because the ability to express yourself and communicate with other people in whatever way, whether it's to tell them, you know, you're not feeling well or whatever, is probably a fundamental problem. But it's not one you would normally think, well, that needs to be, I need to work on that.
Yeah, and I think that's possibly because it's less obvious. You know, you can see, if you see someone who's using crutches or using a wheelchair, you can see that physical disability from a distance before you meet the person, before you know anything about the person. But you really have to speak to somebody before you hear their speech or their language, or you notice any difficulties with that area.
Right.
And I think that's maybe why it goes less noticed. And I think that's why we kind of have to promote our service a little bit more, like so on these podcasts?
No, I mean, I can see the sense in that, to be honest with you. I suppose because it didn't affect me terribly, I probably put it on the back burner, but I can see why it would affect a lot of people, quite badly.
And it can really have, you know, when you really think about it, you need your speech for so many things. If you're in a dangerous situation and you need to call 999, or
even
things
right.
Like today, coming and ordering a coffee.
Well, the advantage of here is you can actually, if you didn't speak, you can still press all the necessary touch sensitive bits of the screen.
Okay. And we are quite lucky to have technology for that, because most things you can do with your phone, but communication and speech and language therapy looks at more than just using your voice. It looks at things like your reading skills to be able to do that.
True. I'm going to have to. I disagree with you on one point. Uh-huh. I think technology has its benefits. From a purely personal point of view, it's absolutely horrific.
Really?
Oh, I can't stand it.
Is that because of?
I'm rotten at it.
Because you're rotten at it.
If you give me a computer, I'll break it straight away.
Really?
Uh-huh. It's a bit of a standing joke.
I'm a wee bit like that myself, to be honest, Alan. I can muck around with them, and I can cause things to break, but.
I'm surprised, because you're young enough to have grown up with it, you know.
Well, I am, yeah, but it's always changing, it's ever changing, isn't it?
Possibly. So I suppose the other thing now, this is where I'm going to sound obtuse, that speech and language therapy covers a whole multitude of sins, does it not? Like, for example, the ability to eat properly.
Exactly, yeah, absolutely. It's more than it says in the name, isn't it? It's not just your speech and your language, it's your ability to do a lot of different things, you know, including eating and drinking.
So if someone's got a problem swallowing, mm-hmm. whether it's a child or an adult, how do you go about, how do you address that to make it better, so to speak?
Well, that would kind of depend on, you know, kind of personal factors to that person. So we would have to do an assessment. Uh-huh. And it kind of requires quite a lot of specialist assessment as well. So what I could do, which isn't much without the support of Jan, because I would need the training.
Okay.
But what we could do is we could do an assessment where we could have a look at their eating and drinking, and see how they're managing, and ask them a lot of it's asking questions, you know. What are the difficulties you're having? Are you finding that you're coughing? Really get a bigger picture of what's going on. And that would help us to inform whether we wanted to send them for specialist assessment, which would be a kind of effectively like an x-ray of their swallow.
Is that essentially the brain trying to tell the mouth and the throat that it's not giving them the right signals?
It can be, or it can be weakness of the muscles that we use for chewing. You know, if you don't have the strength in your muscles in your jaw that you do now, you might find it hard to chew things like a steak or even a bar of chocolate.
Right. I suppose I find that quite difficult, because I can probably eat okay.
Yeah.
The problem I have is one where, having had the knock in the head, you've lost a lot of the sense of taste and smell, which doesn't makes eating a real bite. There's no pleasure in it.
Right, okay.
I suppose I don't have the problem swallowing, but eating food's got the fun out of it, it's gone. It's
just is that still the same for you, Alan?
I would say so. Strongly flavoured stuff like curries and stuff like that, I'll get to an extent, mm-hmm. not the same way as I used to.
So has that changed what types of things you do eat? Do you prefer to go for spicy options or...?
Generally speaking, if I'm going for a curry, it'll be pretty spicy.
Yeah.
But I think the years of eating certain types of food, like sourdough bread with loads of butter on it, or toasted, my brain still tells me that I like that, even though I can taste, I don't get much taste out of it. But my brain still says you like that, so you'll eat it. Same with you know, milk chocolate.
That's really interesting. So you wouldn't go for the darker chocolate, the healthier option?
No, I can eat darker chocolate, but I can't eat as much of it.
So you still prefer the milk chocolate?
Oh, uh-huh.
Oh, that's very interesting.
If you got me a big bar of chocolate, it would last about, I'd be lucky if it lasted a day.
That is very interesting. Because I thought that there might have been, you know, the one almost upside to that is that you could eat healthy and you wouldn't mind as much.
Well, I think that the lady that I'm currently going out with thinks she's died and gone to heaven, because stuff that I would have turned my nose up at, like salads and stuff like that, that I would have thought, looked at it and said, I'm just not eating that. I now have, because it doesn't taste anything, I'll now eat it without any great problem.
But you're maybe not enjoying the things you used to like quite as much.
Definitely.
But you still like the family bar of chocolate.
I still do, yeah. See, that's just because my brain's saying, well, uh-huh. I still like this.
Yeah.
Same for that, coffee. I mean, I drink my coffee strong, but I mean, that I always have done.
And I think what you said there a minute ago, Alan, about having, you know, because you're managing to eat fine, it's quite hard to imagine that people find it different. And that kind of takes me back to what I was saying about the course at uni. It's so good to have that practical side, because it's hard to just hear that and understand it and take it in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when you really see that in somebody that it helps you, you know, to concrete that in your,
I mean, at uni, what did you enjoy out of the course?
I enjoyed the placements.
Right, more than the theory?
I would say so, yeah. I enjoyed going and meeting people and getting a wee bit of a glimpse of their journey, I suppose, in speech and language therapy. And everybody's so different, you know, and I think that's the interesting thing. You know, you're saying you've not had a lot of difficulty with your speech and language, so it's hard to imagine. And when you see such a variety of different people with so many different difficulties, it shows you really just how broad communication is. Because there's people, you know, I've worked with people who could have a conversation and sound okay. Their speech sounds okay, but they're having some difficulties that you just don't really see or hear until you're looking for it.
I think that probably is true of me as well, because you know, we're having this chat, and it wouldn't surprise me if somewhere during this chat that I repeat a question to you, because although I'll express it okay, I won't probably remember that I've been down that particular route already, which is a problem to some extent, because people will get fed up hearing me ask or say the same thing.
The same thing, and that's because of a difficulty with your memory. So that's, you know, it's not necessarily your speech or your language, but it's a it's an area of communication that can be difficult, because it might impact your conversations with people.
I think it does, and I think it probably affects your self-confidence to an extent, because you don't remember that you've been down that particular road before.
Mm-hmm.
And other people can then get quite frustrated to some extent. Mm-hmm. With the fact that you're asking them the same thing repetitively.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the same thing repetitively.
So that's quite interesting, Alan, because a few minutes ago you said, you know, you find it quite hard to imagine having difficulties with your communication. And actually, now that we're speaking a wee bit more about it, you're saying, well, this maybe isn't, that maybe has impacted in conversations.
Well, I suppose the difficulty that I have with that, okay, is that I probably have the ability to express myself okay.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is the short-term memory. I mean, my daughter will say something to me, you know, or possibly not so much her, my girlfriend will say something like, remember the such and such, and I haven't a clue.
Mm-hmm.
That I've been there. Now, that's not necessarily, I don't feel that's necessarily a problem with my speech, though. Is that not more a problem that if with the way the mind's going? I think somewhere in the notes that I have, I've sort of touched on that. I can't remember what it's called. Is it
cognitive communication?
Having read the bits on cognitive communication, I just think it's me to a large extent.
It's what, sorry?
It's me.
It's you?
Uh-huh.
So you feel like that's the kind of difficulties that you have in your communication?
And
I feel
very, very much so.
You know, and that's what kind of wanted to touch on with you earlier, Alan, that, you know, even in this short conversation that we're having, that's not a thing that I've picked up on, because you've not asked me the same question twice.
I know, but I've been trying hard not to do that, because again, I don't think it reflects particularly well on myself, and I want to appear, you know, to the to everybody that I'm 100% okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not. That's not necessarily the case. You are right. It's a hidden disability.
Yeah.
But it's quite a hard one to live with at times.
So what kind of things are you doing kind of support that?
Oh, that's a tough question. Let's put it this way. When I came out of rehab, I talked to my former employers, who weren't that interested in taking me back. And so essentially I had early retirement. That has to an extent changed, because there's another firm who have sort of taken me on part time. Now, prior to that, I was working on the physical side. Right? I was going to the gym, I was swimming a lot, I was trying to get myself fit, trying to get my I've got problems, I don't, an old problem with my knee, I'm trying to cure that and help that. And I'm trying to lose some weight at the same time. The fact that I'm back in a working environment, it's like exercising my brain to a large extent. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's probably not doing me a great deal of harm. I've looked at the cognitive communication stuff, and I think a lot of that it strikes me as it's repetition, is it not? You know, repetition of a particular thing. I think the stuff that I got flung at me in rehab was lists of words that were unconnected. Mm-hmm. And that I had to try and remember as much of those lists that I could. Now, I didn't do that especially well, I don't think. And without trying to brag, I'm relatively well educated. Mm-hmm. That's not fair. I am relatively well educated. Whether I could still do what I did then, because it was reliant upon having a good memory, I think it's very doubtful.
And what did you do before, Alan? Sorry for me asking. You were a lawyer before. Uh-huh. So you think you would struggle with...
I got through the law degree because not because I was incredibly intelligent, but because I had a pretty good memory.
And that's now an area that you're struggling with?
Uh-huh.
And are you finding that there's anything that you're able to do that's helping you? You know, do you write things down?
You have to develop techniques to try and improve things, and I do. I mean, I write a lot more notes. I mean, if you want to see my kitchen table is effectively my brain. Mm-hmm. Because it's got things laid out on it that will remind me to do things. I mean, I was always at work. From a work point of view, I never had a clear desk ever. Okay, I had piles here, there, and everywhere. Mm-hmm. And having that, having the things in a specific pile, what meant that there were things that I had to do or not do, or do soon or do not so soon. Mm-hmm. So I've always been like that, but it's been exaggerated a lot more because of the time that I spent and because of the brain injury. There's no doubt about that.
And I think that's kind of the hard thing to do, Alan. It's getting used to that, isn't it? It's getting used to that change, in a sense, because if before you used your memory fairly easily, fairly quickly, you know, if you were the type of person who had everything in their head, it's then hard to, you know, it's a kind of change of lifestyle, because you now have to start writing notes, and like mm-hmm. you said, you know, you have to put your thoughts and on paper so that you can remember it and to help you organise those thoughts.
Yeah,
so
that's very true. But the thing that now we're supposed to be talking about speech and language therapy. I'm not quite so certain that what that covers my basic problem. I mean, I've read the stuff on the cognitive communication theory, mm-hmm. and it, I look at it and I think, Jesus Christ, that's me, okay? But I'm not so sure. And you can tell me if this is right or wrong. I'm not so sure if that is something that speech therapy necessarily will make right or will help with.
So I think the thing is, Alan, you know, you have cognition and then you have cognitive communication. And cognitive communication is when an area of your cognition, which could be your memory, uh-huh. or your attention, is affecting your communication. So speech and language therapy isn't necessarily looking at fixing your cognition, but how that's impacting on your communication on a day-to-day basis. So
yeah, but I mean, I see that, but
so that might be things like, you know, your memory of this conversation. You know, if during this conversation you're forgetting things that you've said and forgetting things that I've said, or even being able to pay attention. So I can see that you're pretty well able to pay attention.
The only thing I would say is that my attention span now is probably less than it used to be. I was able to concentrate on a specific topic much better beforehand. I find that trickier now. I mean, for example, I've always only ever bought one paper a week. A Saturday or a Sunday paper, bigger, longer, had more in it, more sport effectively as well, sports pages. I find that much more difficult to actually pay specific attention to the news in general, and to take that in. Now, I think that's me, that I've got the flaw, but I'm not entirely certain how that links into speech therapy. Does that make sense?
I see what you're saying. I think in terms of, you know, so what you're talking about is your ability to pay attention to the information mm-hmm. that you're hearing and to remember that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, is that having an impact on your communication?
Well, I don't think it impacts on my communication because, essentially, you know, we're talking, and for me, that's communication. Now, the question for me is whether I'm understanding that communication, which I think I probably am. If you were to sit and say to me, right, Alan, write down on a piece of paper the order in which we discuss things, right? Mm-hmm. I would probably have got that reasonably well beforehand. I'm not so sure I would now. Okay. I would if as we went on, I wrote it down point by point. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not so sure that I would remember it, you know, come the end of this chat.
Neither would I. If you asked me to do that at the end, neither would I. I think that's quite exceptional that you could do that before.
Well, I was not bad. I mean, the problem I had. I mean, I was, as I said already, I was reasonably well educated. The problem is that I've had 15 years. I've been epileptic for 30 years. I've had 15 of that has been uncontrolled. And every time I had, I feel like I'm talking too much of myself. Every year I had every time I had a fit, it would have some impact upon my mental abilities, right? Mm-hmm. So if I've had 15 years of uncontrolled epilepsy, I'm going to have had a few fits, right? Mm-hmm. And the other problem is that I've got older. And I've had the bump in the head. So if you put all three of those things together, my brain power, the power of my brain is going to have pretty much greatly diminished. Which one is having the most effect, I don't really know.
And I think what you were saying before, Alan, you know, not everyone who has difficulties with their memory, you know, not, that's not always going to impact on their communication, you know, and it depends on the severity, and it also depends on what they use their communication for. If you have a really communication dependent job, then
I can see that.
Some people, you know, who have maybe memory difficulties where, but I could maybe read an answer to them in this question, and then, and you know, in this process, where they wouldn't really be able to remember much of what I'd said, to be able to pick up the key points of what I've said, to be able to then ask a follow-up question. Whereas you're managing that fairly well.
Yeah, but let's put it this way. The preparation that I did to host this, I had made notes which I had written down. I've got written down and whatnot to try and give me some assistance. I've probably diverged from them pretty badly. I had a sequence of that where I thought I was going to, you know, try and follow, and I had, you know, I'd researched some of the medical terms, if you like. To try and take that in a short space of time was pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And to remember the sequence in which I was going to talk about or to come to them, or the way I was going to come to them, I think I'm way off mark. Now, I suppose, with all due respect to speech therapists, I do wonder how that is linked to my speech, because my speech for me is something that comes naturally, and I'm probably quite lucky in that regard. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people who have had problems where their speech is nothing like as good as it could or would have been.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and I think there's a difference between speech and overall communication. Because you're picking up, you're saying that, you know, where you kind of plan to go with this conversation, you've maybe diverted away from that. And that's communication, although it's not your speech, because your speech sounds clear, you know. If I can understand you, whoever's listening to the podcast can understand. But maybe your ability to maintain that path of your conversation has been a wee bit impacted. And it's not, nobody's perfect.
We all have
areas where we have difficulty without brain injury, you know.
But do you think that, I'm grateful for everything, that the way I was looked after in rehabilitation. It didn't change my life, but it kept me sane, if you like. I still wonder whether, for someone like me who had a brain injury, whether the speech side of things was a fundamental. Now, there's no doubt that I was lucky in that regard, but it does make me wonder whether speech therapy is something that is paramount. That's probably unfair, because I can see why it is, and the ability to communicate, etc., with our members of, you know, other public members, or is the important thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm sure that's got a name, but I can't remember what it is. I'm sure I've got it written down somewhere. But I'm absolutely unsure what it is. I'm sure you can tell me what it is, because I can't remember. Is it social something or other?
Your ability to
communicate with other members of the general public. I'm sure that's got a name. Social communication.
Okay, social communication.
Okay, there you go. I couldn't remember it.
And that is,
even though I had got it written down, I couldn't remember what it was.
And that's okay. You know, it's probably a term you hadn't heard of before.
Oh no, it wasn't.
Although you know about communicating socially, which is really what that is.
Uh-huh.
Unless you've been involved in speech and language therapy,
you wouldn't know
the word. Potentially wouldn't have known that phrase, yeah.
No, probably not. And I think probably that's made worse because of the circumstances which we currently find ourselves in. Masks don't help at all.
Absolutely.
I mean, it makes understanding people and their expressions just impossible.
And that's the thing, because we use so much more than just our words, don't we? There's people with very severely impaired speech who can still express themselves to a degree, using our hands and using our face. And mm-hmm. you know, there's so many ways of communicating that we use every day. And that's why it's such a so widespread, well, so, because so you need to be able to do a bit of everything.
That's fundamental, right? Mm-hmm. Tell me something, I don't know why I've come to this point just now, but let's say someone's got a speech problem and they are ethnic. Okay. Do you think it's a benefit to a speech therapist to be trilingual?
That's a very interesting point. I think, I mean, yes, we quite often use interpreters, you know, to translate. Uh-huh. So I think if the speech therapist themselves had that ability, that's only can be a benefit.
Well, I'm not thinking here of, you know, the ability to talk Spanish or French or anything like that. I'm thinking more of, for example, Asians, where there's an increasing number locally in the UK itself, and we've just had all the folk in from Afghanistan who probably will have incredible difficulty speaking English. Mm-hmm. Do you think then it makes sense to try and encourage people from ethnic minorities to become speech therapists?
Very interesting point, Alan. I wonder if they could potentially do some research into that. I'm not aware of, you know, there's not any research that I've read recently. But that's a very interesting point. And I think beyond just the language, I think, you know, the cultural differences that uh-huh. are so important to be aware of when you're working with people. Because it's, you know, we've got quite a personal job. We're in people's personal space, asking personal questions. So I think it's, you know, interesting to know more than just the language, but the uh-huh. their whole cultural background and traditions.
The ability to talk, I mean, not except, for example, if you let's say you've got an Asian who is becoming a speech therapist. Do you not think that the fact that they are probably can speak, you know, Urdu and whatever other languages, you know, for example, Pakistanis can talk. Do you not think that someone who is from that culture is going to be a benefit?
Possibly, absolutely. I think with the same as in any role, really, it's beneficial to have people who can.
Right. Okay.
Communicate.
Just to finish off, I'm gonna ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. You're, I think, going to move on from the rehab that you're currently doing.
I am indeed.
What's the next step?
I'm going to be working for the NHS.
Okay.
And working with kids.
Really?
Which is going to be a big change. Yep.
No, and taking nothing to do with speech therapy, really?
No, it's still speech and language therapy.
Oh, so right, okay. But you're trying to address it at an early age?
At an early age, yes.
Which I think is probably a good
thing.
It's
not necessarily brain injury. It can be, you know, just developmental difficulties. So it'll be a new challenge.
Well, I do wish you all the very best in that. I'm sure it'll be good for you, or not be good for you, but I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Alan.
No, not at all. Hopefully you'll take something from the speech therapy with you.
I believe I will.
Okay.
Well. I wish I could take Jan.
I'm sure she would love to come with you.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining me.
Bye-bye.
Hi, welcome back. It's Jan and...
It's Helen.
Here again. Thanks to Alan and Megan for joining us in this episode. We hope you enjoyed listening to it. Lots for us to reflect on, I think. Isn't there, Helen?
Definitely. I think first and foremost, what shone through was Megan's enthusiasm for her career. It underlines how important it is to be passionate about your job. Obviously, I'm talking from a biased point of view, but I think for anyone in healthcare, it's never just a job. Having core values of compassion and a desire to make life better for others is key. And I genuinely don't think you can work in healthcare without those values. What do you think, Jan?
Totally agree there, Helen. I have had the privilege of working with Megan for over the past 18 months. I have to say she's been an absolute pleasure to work with, and I have been so impressed with her dedication and development. And one thing that does shine through is Megan's commitment to the people she works with. But I must say, the majority of people in our field do love their work, and I feel so fortunate to have the opportunity to work with like-minded people, and both professionals and people with brain injuries.
Yeah, I agree, Jan. I think, you know, we are all very grateful for the people with and that we encounter. I think I'd also like to just mention about something that came up in the conversation about how, in general, our profession of speech and language therapy is often misunderstood. Even today, people still think that all we do is teach people how to talk. And I don't know about you, I think that lack of understanding can sometimes be a hurdle when it comes to getting patients to engage with us. I think we sometimes struggle with getting the right information out there as to the massive range of issues that fall within our remit as speech and language therapists. And even in the realm of brain injury, I've encountered many other health professionals who don't understand cognitive communication difficulties, which is, let's face it, our bread and butter, Jan, working with this client group. And obviously, we hope with this podcast, we're doing something to help bring a wider understanding of it all. But I'd be interested to hear what other ideas perhaps any of our listeners have about what we can do to promote speech therapy and promote cognitive communication difficulties.
Yeah, it is the big question, isn't it? What is it speech and language therapists do? I would like to add a further point for reflection. I was actually present, but not saying anything, which was really difficult for me during the recording. And I wasn't really aware of background noise. However, when I listened to the recording, I was really struck by how much the recording picked up in terms of music in the background and people talking. And it caused me to wonder, is this what it's like for people who wear hearing aids? Or is that what it's like for people with hyperacusis, which is another topic for us to discuss in the future? We people that don't have brain injuries don't tend to notice background noise most of the time, but many people who have had brain injuries are left with some sensory changes, sensory issues. So I think it's important to also, you know, think about that when we're taking people into the community, what may not be noticeable as background noise perhaps to them is actually more significant.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, Jan, and actually it's something that I've thought about a couple of times listening to one or two other podcasts. Other brain injury podcasts are available, where I know that they have chosen not to use things like background music or the kind of little interruptions that I know that we occasionally have in our episodes, because people with brain injuries can find it difficult to adjust to those shifts in noise. So if you are listening and you have a brain injury and you find that difficult with our podcast, we would be interested to hear from you. That was something I think that's really interesting to be mindful of. And I think that the kind of the last big thing that I would want to kind of touch on, Jan, was a point that Alan had raised about diversity in speech and language therapy. And I think we're all aware that diversity and equal representation has been a topic of discussion in so many areas, not just healthcare. And I'm sure we're all aware of movements like Black Lives Matter. And I think professions across the board are becoming more aware of the need for diversity. And RCSLT published an issue of their Bulletin magazine recently, which focused on diversity within the profession. And there's the SLT Time podcast, which I believe is available via YouTube, that does specifically discuss the need for more diversity in speech and language therapy. And I know Alan was speaking from more of a background of having people from maybe black and minority ethnic backgrounds, but even it's fair to say that historically this profession of speech and language therapy has been largely composed of white females, but of course that doesn't reflect the caseloads that we work with, no matter what area of speech therapy you're working in. So it would be interesting to see if we can have more diversity come into the profession in the coming years, won't it?
As always, we could chat for hours about things that have arisen in the course of the episode, but we'll stop ourselves here. We're going to take a break for a few weeks before publishing some more episodes to give us time to line up more guests. And as always, if you have comments, suggestions, or ideas for future topics or podcasts, do link in with us via our social media platforms.
And I'm sure you've heard me say this in pretty much, I think, every other episode, but just a reminder, if this is the first time you've listened to us, we're on Twitter at BrainySLT and on Instagram at BrainySpeechTherapists. As you maybe know, it's myself that tends to do most of the social media activity, and I'm going to try and do better at regularly posting on our accounts. So apologies if you're seeking lots of hot content from us on there. This is the downside of running social media as a hobby. There's never enough time in the day for these things. But you're all my witnesses that I will try and do better. So we're going to sign off there for now for a few weeks. We'll be back soon, and as always, thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.